Yeah, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
It's 1 o'clock, time to jump at Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A lot of news has been about the great growth of inequality over the last three decades in the United States and the difficulty of middle-class and working-class people to survive. We're going to be talking to the head of one of the institutions dedicated to ending that problem. Our guest today is going to be Leo Gerard, president of the United Steelworkers Union, talking to us for the full hour here on Media Matters. Should be a great show. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A group of AT&T shareholders are asking the company to commit to net neutrality principles on its wireless network.
We think network neutrality is important for the health of the economy broadly. And since many of our investors are diversified investors who have holdings in many, many companies, not just media companies, they think it's important that there be an open and robust internet. And so therefore, network neutrality principles are important.
Michael Connor is the executive director of the Open Media and Information Companies Initiative. The nonprofit works with companies and shareholders to develop more responsible and responsive media management practices. Open Mic has filed a proposal for shareholders to vote on net neutrality issues at the annual shareholders meeting in April 2012. Institutional and private investors have signed on, including Mike D. of the Beastie Boys.
When investors speak to the company as investors and speak to them because they think that this is going to be good not just for consumers, but also for the company and its shareholders in the long term, the companies tend to listen.
AT&T will more than likely ask the Securities and Exchange Commission for permission not to include it on their proxy ballot. In years past, the SEC has said that net neutrality is not a significant public policy issue. Connor hopes the SEC will see it differently this time, but he's under no illusions that AT&T's policies will change next year. Open Mic's main goal is to influence the thinking around short-term profits versus long-term gains over time. Connor says the industry is changing quickly, and it's necessary to stay in the fight for an open internet over the long haul.
You need to look at it long-term for the company, long-term for the country, because if the national economy suffers, if we do damage to the internet and we discourage small businesses and we make it difficult for small businesses and individuals to use the internet, and if the national economy suffers, ultimately AT&T's business will suffer.
Open Mic educates and informs the investment community about net neutrality issues. The group plans to bring their proposal to other wireless companies in the future.
We don't necessarily think that there's a contradiction between responsible media management practices and profits. If you look long-term, open internet policies, more responsible management practices are really important, both to these companies and to the country.
To find out more about Open Mic, go to openmic.org.
And here are two updates about our Federal Communications Commission. Last Thursday, the FCC announced that it will move toward digitizing public files and improving program reporting requirements for broadcasters. Broadcasters are not only supposed to serve their local communities in exchange for use of the public airwaves, they're supposed to be transparent about how they do it. These reporting requirements haven't been updated since the 1980s, and media watchdog groups say broadcasters either don't provide useful information to the public or the information isn't accessible to the public. The FCC is hoping to bring broadcasters into the digital era and provide the public with useful information on the local TV stations licensed to serve them. Corey Wright, Policy Counsel for Free Press, said she is encouraged by the FCC's pledge to move swiftly on implementing much-needed reforms. Wright said by updating broadcasters' reporting requirements and putting them online for easy access by viewers, the FCC could significantly improve consumers' ability to hold broadcasters accountable for whether they're using the publicly owned spectrum to serve and inform their communities. President Obama this week nominated Jessica Rosenworcel and Ajit Pai as new FCC commissioners. Rosenworcel is currently a top advisor to Senator Jay Rockefeller, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee. She would replace Democratic Commissioner Michael Copps, whose term expires at the end of the year. Pai, who served previously at the FCC in the Office of the General Counsel, is a partner at law firm Jenner & Block. He would replace Republican Commissioner Meredith Atwell Baker, who left the FCC to join Comcast last May.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, so please feel free to call in with your questions or comments. Before we go to our guest, I do want to give you an update from the Pledge Drive show we held 2 weeks ago. We received 85 pledges over the air or via the internet. A number came in late from people who listened to the podcast. And I want to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for your support for this show and for WILL. And I know John Nichols, my dear friend who joins me for these pledge drives, was very excited to hear the news too, and he wants to thank you as well. Now let's go to our guest. Our guest today, Leo Gerard, is the president since 2001 of the United Steelworkers Union, and he's a member of the AFL-CIO Executive Committee as well as serving on its Executive Council. He works as the chair of the AFL-CIO's Public Policy Committee. He is one of the giants of the modern labor movement, and it's an honor to have him on our show. Leo Gerard, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you. It's a real honor and privilege and pleasure to be on.
Well, let's get right down to business. I must say, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm 58 years old, and I remember when I was a paper boy delivering the Cleveland Plain Dealer for much of the 1960s, I didn't read the front page a whole heck of a lot, but I had to notice it on the way to the sports section. And just by doing that alone and listening to the news on the AM pop radio stations, the top 40 stations in the 40s, I knew and all my friends knew the names of the heads of the major, the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, the auto workers, as well as we would know members of Congress or international leaders. They were just key players in the society of Cleveland, Ohio of the 1960s. And I dare say that's not the case today. We've seen labor really in a very different position vis-a-vis its role of society than it had a generation or two back. And I wonder, just for starters, if you could put some numbers on it, like what percentage of American workers today are represented by trade unions compared to, you know, 50 years ago, something like that?
Well, it's substantially less. Depending on whose numbers you accept, it's somewhere around 13%. If you do it in the private sector, it's somewhere below 10%.
And what is it? I'm sorry, go ahead, Leo.
The right wingers would like you to think that that's because less people want to join the union, but that's absolutely not the case. In fact, in almost constant polling numbers, people want to join unions if they had the opportunity.
And in other industrial countries, like your native country of Canada or Western European democracies, what are the union totals there? What percentage of the workforce tends to be unionized in other nations?
In Canada, it's about 33%.
Which is what it was in the U.S. 50 years ago?
Yeah, roughly.
Roughly?
And in Nordic or Scandinavian countries, it's in the almost 50% range, and in one or two countries, it's in the 80% range. In Germany and France, Germany and Spain, I should say, that again, they're in the high 40s.
So, go ahead, Leo. I'm sorry.
If you keep that figure in mind, in Germany, Germany's now got higher labor costs than we do in America on average. They have a balanced trade agenda with China. Their manufacturing portion of their economy is upwards of 25 to 27%, again, depending on which year and which economist. Whereas in America, the manufacturing part of our economy is down to 10%.
So we've got a couple of issues right here, Leo Gerard, to talk about. First of all, let's talk about why it is that American workers want to be part of unions as much as they ever have by polling data and survey data, yet the numbers plummeted while in our peer countries around the world, the numbers remain roughly the same or at least is significantly higher than it is in the United States. You know, why is that?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, the law for workers to be able to join unions in America is the worst in the OECD countries. I could pick countries and say, do you think it's worse than Mexico? Do you think it's worse than South Africa? Do you think it's worse than Brazil? Do you think it's worse than Spain? In all of those countries, labor law is superior. The right to workers to join a union is superior. The other thing that has really diminished the ability of workers to join unions is the ongoing loss of the manufacturing base. Manufacturing makes up 10% of gross domestic product. We've lost 58,000 factories in America in the last 10 years, and most of those factories were lost by moving to either Mexico, China, Vietnam, Indonesia. Very few of those factories have moved to Europe or north to Canada.
And you were making a point earlier, President Gerard, that a country like Germany, which has higher labor costs than the United States, so by the conventional wisdom of the U.S., would not be an attractive place for people to set up shop for manufacturing concerns, it still maintains a much higher percentage of its economy devoted to manufacturing, even with higher labor costs, and has not seen a similar fleeing of jobs to low-wage countries. Is that right?
Yeah. And part of it is that, first of all, their labor law encourages collective bargaining and trade unionism because they see that as a vehicle for having shared prosperity. And in addition, they've got a strategy both on what we would call social infrastructure, the health care and retiree benefits and things like that. And they've got a strategy for their own infrastructure. As an example, using France as an example, France just put out tenders for modernizing their high-speed rail system beginning in the year 2015. We don't even have the high-speed rail system that France has now, and they're already putting out tenders to upgrade their system 10 years from what they did in 2010, so they were planning 5 years ahead. We can't plan 5 weeks ahead.
Our guest today, who you're listening to here on Media Matters, is Leo Gerard, the president of the United Steelworkers, joining us live on the phones. If you have any questions or comments for Leo Gerard, the number here, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number at Media Matters is 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's go back to that issue, if we can, President Gerard, of the difficulty American workers have forming unions. And I know that back in the 2008 presidential election, one of the reasons that was given to people who were liberal or progressive why it was very important to support President Obama's campaign, then Senator Obama's campaign for the presidency, was that he was a firm proponent of the what I think came to be called or was then called the Employee Free Choice Act, where we should make it possible for workers when they had a majority to transition to getting legal union representation without having to go to a three-month public relations blitzkrieg by management. I don't know if I got that exactly right.
You've got it pretty right.
And so this was one of the great promises of the Obama election. Whatever came of the Employee Free Choice Act?
Yeah, look at the put it in perspective. There's a lot of people that have tried to blame President Obama for lots of stuff. And let me back up a bit, that the Employee Free Choice Act was passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives under the leadership of Speaker Pelosi. And it had many Republican votes at that time. Then it got to the Senate, out of the House of Representatives. And in the Senate, it got filibustered by the Republicans. And unfortunately, we lost a couple of Democrat senators. Blanche Lincoln would be one. Ben Nelson would be another. So we were unable to break the filibuster. And we, to be honest, we were pretty angry at both of them. And the labor movement campaigned aggressively in the primary for a different person than Blanche Lincoln. And as a result of that, we think we helped defeat her. Now, some people might think that was crazy, but, that was a betrayal of the labor movement, because she had told us that she would support if it came to a final vote.
Well, let's go to the phone lines right now, Leo Gerard, and then we'll resume this issue. Our lines are open again at Media Matters at 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller, Line 1, Champagne. You're on the air with Leo Gerard of the United Steelworkers. Yes, Line 1. Okay, it looks like we're having some issues with Line 1. They're not there. Employee Free Choice Act, President Gerard, did not pass. And this, how many new trade unions or unions have been formed in the private sector in the last 25, 30 years without the Employee Free Choice Act?
Well, the rate, if you mean local unions, the rate of unionization has been in constant decline. And to the point where the National Labor Relations Board doesn't work. And in fact, in the Bush board for 8 years, they did everything they can to make sure you couldn't succeed in a organizing campaign. And it's been part of the philosophy of the folks that have been, as we're now saying, rewarding the one percenters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the most democratic way to distribute wealth, if that's the right term, is through collective bargaining. If you work in a factory, you want your employer to be productive, you want your employer to be successful, and then you want to have a chance to get your piece of that pie. And the most effective way of doing it is through collective bargaining, where you sit down. And what's amazing is management, CEOs, they negotiate their salary. They bring in lawyers and everybody. They belong to associations. I mean, they belong to the National Manufacturers Association because they understand they need collective action. They bargain their contracts with their suppliers and their customers, yet they want to deny that same right to workers. And the main reason for the constant decline in the rate of unionization is the labor law doesn't work. And it hasn't been changed, improved in close to 50 years.
Well, the one branch where organized labor has managed to remain relatively strong has been in the public sector. And I would imagine just primarily because government bodies can't really engage in the same sort of union busting techniques as a rule that private firms can engage in. And they can't move their jobs abroad as easily and use that threat. There have been, in the year 2011, one of the great developments has been in a number of states around the country, generally states with a Republican control of both the legislature and the governorship. There have been laws passed to effectively make it impossible to have public sector unions, most notably, of course, Wisconsin and Ohio. And you've been greatly involved, I know, in these movements in those states to preserve the right of public sector workers to have trade unions and have union representation. And there is a huge election coming up in 2 days in Ohio. Can you give us your assessment of what's going on in Ohio and how that's playing out?
Well, I was in Ohio most of the day yesterday, and again, I don't want to jinx the process. But based on what we heard and what I saw and the doors we knocked on, I would think that people in Ohio are going to give Kasich a sound defeat on his union-busting law. And as I said at one of the rallies, tell me the last time that a firefighter or policeman, a public employee, brought the economy to its knees. It doesn't happen. I could probably go to almost any school in Ohio other than a private school and find teachers who are subsidizing the school by buying supplies for their classrooms with their own salaries.
Mm-hmm.
If you grew up in Cleveland, you would know that the deindustrialization of Cleveland has starved many of the school boards in the Cleveland area in Mahoning County of their tax base. People don't connect, Robert, people don't connect the closure of the industrial base of the country to the lack of jobs, to the lack of tax revenue. If you think of a factory that has 200 people, they buy their supplies locally. They have the safety truck coming to sell boots. They have the restaurant down the street. They have the folks that move the equipment in and out of what's being produced. And those 200 people pay taxes. That employer pays taxes. Those taxes support the infrastructure of the community, whether it's the fire department or the bus service, the bus transit. Once you dismantle that, you dismantle the infrastructure. So these corporations that have moved to China and moved to Mexico, their CEOs are doing very well. Their stock is doing very well. They're making bigger profits. They're just not having any structure to distribute it, whether it's through the tax base or whether it's through paying employees. When you move a job from Pittsburgh, where the average rate might have been $16 an hour, and you move it to China, where it's $16 a week, who gets the benefit of that? Not the people in Pittsburgh.
There are very many people in China based on those salaries.
Yeah.
Our guest today, Leo Gerard, president of the United Steelworkers here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you this November 6, 2011. So if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for President Gerard, the lines are open at 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. President Gerard, I had the privilege of seeing you speak in Madison, Wisconsin during the winter at one of the rallies at the state capitol. And I, you know, one of the things that occurred to me when I was at that rally and at the witnessing it and participating in it and subsequent events was that while this was a very strong attack on organized labor, it was also in some ways it served to draw attention to the issues of organized labor in a public way that hadn't been the case almost in my lifetime.
Well, what happened is in some ways the light switch got turned on for a lot of people. And I'm not sure what the right word is, but the dots got connected.
Mm-hmm.
When you start attacking the teachers and pretending that the economic problem is as a result of teacher salaries that are making, $35,000, $40,000 a year, have a pension, and the pension might pay $1,000 a month, or, you know, it's all based on how long you've been there. Turning that into some kind of boondoggle that people are living high on the hog. And so what they've tried to do is take the anxiety and the anger that's out there as a result of the economic collapse brought on by sort of the financial skullduggery of Wall Street and tried to turn that anger against the victims of Wall Street. And I think that's where Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement has redirected a lot of that frustration.
And you've been a strong supporter of the Occupy Wall Street movement, if I'm not mistaken, reading some of your columns that you've written over the last a month or so. Assuming that's accurate, can you give me your assessment of what you think they've done so far and where this movement's going?
Well, I think I think what they've done is galvanize public opinion. And if you sort of track it for a while, it went for a couple of weeks where it got no attention. And then, in particular, when the police moved in, it got a lot of attention and the thing just mushroomed. I was proud that we were having a young workers' conference with young workers from our union and the AFL-CIO. And our young workers started sending me phone calls and emails saying, are we going to do anything? Or can we go? Are we supporting this? And immediately we issued a press statement supporting the Occupy movement. And not because of our press statement, but our press statement was early. And then we started to see Occupy movements all over the place. And what it is, it's the galvanizing of the anger and the frustration. And unlike the Tea Party, which was funded by billionaires and millionaires, and the Occupy movement is really ultimate grassroots. People are just coming together and saying enough is enough. I think if I have any concerns, it's that it's got to turn itself into a movement for change, and we have to be able to articulate the change. It's not sufficient to simply be in the park yelling at buildings. I think we've got to be in the parks all over the country, and we've got to start to express that the majority in this country want a different kind of an economy, want an economy of shared prosperity, want workers to be able to go to work and have some security, whether it's on the job security, it's whether it's safety in their workplace, whether it's the ability to look ahead and say, okay, if I work hard, play by the rules, at the end I'll be able to retire with some dignity. And the same thing, quite frankly, is happening in Washington now. We're having this stupid debate over the deficit. The deficit would be eliminated, gone, zero, if we got down to a much lower level of unemployment that would be acceptable, like 5-6. Even that's unacceptable. Getting to that would eliminate the deficit. Doing away with the Bush tax cuts. I mean, it's been nothing, you know, and if tax cuts created jobs, George Bush should have left with full employment. Instead, he left with an economy in total tatters.
Our guest, Leo Gerard, here at Media Matters. Let's go to the phone lines for another caller, if we can. Let's start with line one here, Champaign County. You're on the air with President Leo Gerard of the United Steelworkers.
Yeah. I'm wondering if the steelworkers are down with this and can give me an update on, and I don't see this as a solution in the long run, but in the interim, I understand that some of the unions are talking about mobilizing their pension funds into kind of a bank for employment because, you know, they're getting so little for it anyway, and it's actually invested in, you know, finance capital, probably, that they're talking about pulling the money out and actually trying to get some things happening on the ground, whether steelworkers are behind that. And then in stark contrast to that kind of movement, what's been offered by the Obama administration is this investment scheme of, I forget what the buzzword for it is, but I've read numerous critiques of it, but not lately, so it's probably not getting the publicity it needs. This infrastructure bank, I guess, is what they were calling it. But that's just another way to deal finance in instead of doing the infrastructure directly, it seems to me. And then that's a lot to chew on, but I also, since you're a steelworker, I wanted to applaud your work for Columbia. It's not just because Drummond Cole's down there, but you, for the longest time, had this attorney, Kowalczyk, I guess is how his name is said, working on the case.
Yes.
And I just want to applaud that, and that obviously leaves you an opening to say something about so-called free trade, which a large dimension of that apparently, as always, is protection of investment vehicles. So I understand some of the sub-clauses in the so-called free trade agreement actually disallow anybody from complaining about derivatives and the machinations of these bogus financial instruments that don't do anything except jack up the casino economy. So I appreciate your work. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. And Leo, he's got a lot there to chew on. Let's start with the whole issue of these so-called free trade deals. The New York Times has called you the number one scourge of free traders. And I got that, I think, from your website. So clearly that's a designation you embrace. And why don't you explain to our listeners why what free trade really is in your view, why the name is misleading, and what we should really be thinking about it.
Okay, well, let me reinforce what you said, that not only I, but our union are proud to wear that as a badge of honor, because there has not been a trade deal that America has signed that has resulted and a net job increase for America. You'll have them come out and say that exports have gone up 15% with country Y. They never tell you that imports have gone up 35%. And so I've challenged everybody that I can come in contact with to put together a report that shows me the net job creation on any of these trade deals, and no one has done that yet. And calling them free trade deals is misdesignation. They're not about trade. They're about investment. They're investment deals that make it opportunistic for any multinational company, especially including banks, to set up shop in any country where they've got one of these deals, and to do it with the least interference by government possible. They even do it where they give the entity, the company, national designation. There's been lawsuits between the United States and Canada and Mexico over one country or another having alleged rules that make it harder for the other company in that country to make a profit. For example, one of the major U.S. Delivery operations, I can't remember if it was FedEx or UPS, but one of them sued Canada because Canada has a national postal service. A Canadian company sued an American company over funeral rules. I mean, so these got nothing to do with trade in the end. They're about investment deals. And so we have fought every one of them. We'll continue to fight every one of them. We'll continue to mobilize our members, continue to educate them, continue to take that as a fundamental issue to the polls, and make one point on that. PNTR, normalized trade relations, preferential trade relations with China, has resulted in 60% of what we import from China used to be made in America. America's two largest exports to China are scrap metal and waste paper. Both of those have made the cost of our inputs in our steel and paper industry much more expensive, because we have to compete with China even for the scrap metal, and they don't give a darn what it costs them. So these aren't trade deals. And the other point that the caller raised about...
Let me do a follow-up on the trade before we get to pensions, Leo Gerard, which is, you know, on these deals, I mean, the labor movement in general, and I think this includes the steel workers and certainly the AFL-CIO, has put an enormous amount of support behind the Democratic Party and Democratic candidates. And this issue is really, along with Employee Free Choice Act, is a defining issue for organized labor. I mean, what grade do you give the Obama administration on its handling of trade deals so far?
On the handling of the three trade deals that the president has brought to the Congress, I'd give them an F, a failure.
Mm-hmm.
On enforcement of the existing trade rules, I would give them A+. They have been extremely, extremely aggressive and supportive of the multitude of trade cases our union has brought forward. And the reason I would give them an F on the other trade deals is that... there's no reason to have them, except that big business wants them, and they want them for wrong reasons, and they mislead. Everybody in Washington misleads us on these things. Again, they're not about trade, they're about investment. In addition to that, they're not being candid about why they want to do them. They want a trade deal with Colombia not because of just trade and investment. They want it because they want to have Colombia closer to the American access, because democracy in South America is electing progressive governments. Whether look at Brazil. Lula da Silva left more popular than he came in, and Brazil is growing because he put in a strategy. He's lifted tens of millions of people out of poverty, while us in America, with no strategy, have put tens of millions of people into poverty. If you look at what they're doing in Chile, of using their resources to grow their economy. So that's keep Colombia the only really right-wing gang in South America, closer to America. You go to Panama, we want to keep Panama close because we want to make sure that we always control the canal. If you go to South Korea, they want that deal. I mean, hell, you go into a store, you can't find any electronic product that doesn't have LG on it. I was dumb enough at one time to think that was my initials. LG is for life is good. Life is good in Korea. They're sending us everything they got. But in addition, we lowered the standard. A vehicle coming from Korea to America, if it has 35% Korean content, will be considered a Korean vehicle. Well, guess what? They're going to get their parts, because Korean workers are also opposing this deal. They're going to get their parts from China and Vietnam, put them in those Korean cars and ship them over here. And then we're going to have only 35% domestic content requirement for a car from here. And so we'll get our parts from Mexico and Vietnam and China. Imports of auto parts from China has gone up 900%. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out.
Let's go to the pensions question, if we can, Leo Girard. Is your union thinking about taking the pension funds and putting it directly into investment to create jobs and expand the economy?
We've been doing that. I was really interested in the question because when I was Secretary Treasurer, along with Rich Trumka, who was Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, we started a capital strategies program where we started to mobilize workers' capital to create jobs. And in fact, we did a book called Workers' Capital. If the listener is still on, he could get that book. And
I'm sure he's still listening.
Yeah, it's called Workers' Capital, and it was a series of essays of things that we could do with workers' capital and to mobilize for jobs. And what drove me to that was that the asset managers that were managing workers' pension funds, which, to be honest, I don't have the handle on now because the economy is in such a mess, but 10 years ago had over $400 billion of assets if you took collectively workers' pension funds. The asset manager of that were using that to, as an example, move a plant out of Washington State to China, yet that community where that plant would be, whose teachers were paying into that fund, whose steel workers were paying into their pension funds, their pension fund money was being used to move jobs to China. And we thought that was nuts. So we started to challenge that. And we were making a fair amount of progress. And we've mobilized a lot of money. And we've created investment funds that are more directly involved in creating jobs in America. And we've got to do more. And in fact, there's a study going on now about the establishment of state banks and growing credit unions. Again, that sort of shot up like a rocket out of the ground mm-hmm. when Bank of America wanted to start charging $5 to access your own money. And people started moving their money. That has just blossomed. Close to 800,000 people have now indicated that they're going to move their money from a big bank to a state bank or a credit union.
And I think the latest figure I saw is over 500,000 already have, not to mention they plan to. Our guest, Leo Girard from the United Steelworkers, the president of the United Steelworkers, also a member of the AFL-CIO Executive Committee and serving on its Executive Council. This is a live show on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a few callers who have been waiting patiently. I'm going to get to them straight away. But if you do want to join them and get in the queue, the number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's now go to line 2, Champaign. You're on the air with Leo Girard.
Yes, I have a question that's been gnawing at me for a while. We're facing a presidential election this year, and one of the great American mysteries is why is it that among the labor unions and the middle class generally, there's so many Republican votes? When you hear about 999 and flat tax and doing away with Social Security, you would expect the middle class would wipe the Republicans right off the map. But nevertheless, you take a typical union, there's going to be lots of Republican votes there. The Republicans are hoping for to win next year. Now, common sense tells you that if people vote their own economic interests, the Republicans would have a hard time being elected dog catcher somewhere. But nevertheless, they're there and they're making a lot of noise. So how do you explain that so many people in the middle class do not vote their own economic interests? That's my question.
Thank you very much, caller. Leo Gerard?
Boy, if I had that answer, I'd put it in a bottle. I have my views about it, but I don't have a definitive answer. Part of this, and this is not an American phenomenon, it happens. In fact, I'm going to Great Britain on Wednesday because we created a global institution called Workers Uniting between the largest unions in Britain in the private sector and the steelworkers, and we're trying to develop a international response to the global financial mess. But if I sort of think about what happens here, we get a lot of misinformation. If you look at the stories we're told about and the language that's used about investment deals that get called free trade, we get told that teachers are the problem. We get all of this stuff. One of the probably most troubling things in America is the American political system is marinated in money. I mean, if you watch what happened in Wisconsin just this week, somebody set up a front group to recall Walker earlier this week because that opens a 60-day period. I think that's the amount of time. It opens a
that's
length
right.
of time where he can raise unlimited, undisclosed amounts of money. And there's no other country on earth that would call itself a democracy where that is being tolerated. In fact, if you think back, America was bragging when the Iraqis could put their finger in a jar of purple ink and hold their finger up, they voted. And one of the things that's going on in America is there's voter suppression going on in at least 27 states. Money is flowing into the system, and it disenfranchises ordinary people. When you make it harder for people to vote, the people it's going to be hardest on are the people that need government the most. And so that's one of the problems. Money in the system is another problem. Improper information is another problem. And cynicism, I mean, I think the two most successful presidents of my lifetime, and I'm 64 years old, was Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Ronald Reagan because he was able to succeed in telling ordinary working-class people that government's the enemy, when in reality it's working-class people that need government, need regulations, need rules, need help, need to make sure that their bus system works, need to make sure that their kids get a good education, a public education. And then George Bush, because no one transferred as much wealth through the taxation system from working people to the already rich and ultra-rich as George W. Bush. So our challenge is to make sure that we're bringing truth to power, making sure that we're not silent. I'm proud of our union. We've created a rapid response network. Every day, every week, we send information into our local union leaders about the facts and how it affects them. But even then, we've got to combat the cynicism.
You know, Leo Gerard, also, one of the things that you just touched upon is that the news media, as a rule, do not cover labor issues very much. And when they do, they more often than not tend to take the position of management.
Yeah,
and, you know,
right.
This is a major change in American history. As recently as the 1950s, there were several hundred full-time labor correspondents with daily newspapers. It was a standard position. There were as many labor reporters as there were business reporters. And that position doesn't exist anymore. It just simply disappeared.
I don't know any major newspaper that has a designated labor reporter.
No, I've studied this. There isn't any left. They're all gone. I think we lost our last one
in the last decade. Even more than that, there's an editorial bent. For example, they'll talk about mafia bosses and union bosses in the same breath, and they'll characterize the labor movement as being an obstructionist organization. When in the reality, most of the progress we've had in America has come about as a result of collective bargaining and political action that's come as a result of those collective bargaining events. Like they say, the labor movement brought you the weekend. We first fought for a shorter work week that paid decent wages in our collective bargaining agreements. Once we established that it could be done, then it established it legislatively. We first started bargaining about pensions and health care in collective agreements in the 40s and 50s and mid-50s. And then when we started to win, along came some improvements in Social Security and some improvements in that. And so if you can dismantle the labor movement, you can shortchange progress. And they've known that, and that's why from the beginning of the 60s, there's been a concerted attempt to sort of dismantle and try to make the labor movement as ineffective as possible by throwing up every roadblock you could imagine.
We've got two callers waiting patiently for Leo Gerard, the president of the United Steelworkers, our guest today. So let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to, what do we have up here? Line 4, Spring Bay. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Leo Gerard.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to turn it back to steel a little bit. Could you tell me how much steel was made in this country, let's say in 1960, versus this year or last year? And then, how does American-made steel compare in quality with foreign steel? And finally, what's the deal with the big bridge out in California being made by, I believe, Chinese steel when it's a American public works project? If you could comment on that. And I'll get off the line and listen to your answer.
Thank you very much, caller. Leo Gerard?
Yeah, those are really pertinent questions. First of all, the amount of steel that's made in America versus the rest of the world, or how much now relative to the 1960s, roughly about 110 to 150 million tons of steel, and that's a fairly constant number. The problem with that is that steel from all around the rest of the world has grown, and steel imports into the United States that has destroyed steel making capacity, so that it should have been at 200 million tons. Steel imports into the United States from countries like Russia that we took on, India, China, others that we took on in the early 1990s, has chewed up about 35% of our market. In any given month, there's somewhere between 30 and 35% of the steel consumed in America's foreign steel. And lots of that steel is as a result of steel we don't make anymore, grades we don't make, because we've been driven out of that market by dump steel. And we've won, you know, that people, again, the right wing, challenge the steelworkers because we bring cases and to the International Trade Tribunal, Trade Commission. The reality is that we've won probably 50 or 60 cases on different steel products where other countries, other companies are violating the global rules. We think the rules are lousy already, and even there they cheat. So there's that chunk of the market that's chewed up. Let me give you a hard fact for the listener that he can use. United States Steel and the steelworkers did a study. We could make a ton of steel in Pittsburgh, ship it to Beijing cheaper than they could make it in China and ship it to Beijing if the Chinese were using the same kind of traditional business models that we have to use in this country, instead of getting cheap labor, cheap energy, cheap money, free land, no environmental rules. For every ton of steel produced in China, they produce three times the amount of carbon emissions that we produce in the U.S., and that contributes to global warming. When it comes to the quality of the U.S. steel, it's the best steel in the world, North American steel. And you also can look at the fact that we make steel on a per man-hour per basis, man-hours per ton, more efficiently than almost anyone else in the world. And lastly, on the Bay Bridge, that was one of the greatest fiascos that should have people in not just California, but in the country outraged. That is a taxpayer-funded bridge, and under the rules, that bridge should have been put out for bid, And if it's above a certain price, it should be American-made. What Arnold Schwarzenegger and his Department of Transportation did in California, they segmented the bridge into a series of different pieces that were all small enough that anyone could, or any country could bid on them. And a Chinese company won every one of the segments. Then they manufactured the steel. They had to send 250 engineers from America to China to make sure it was, quote, going to be done right. Even when it got done that way, it came back to the area to build the bridge, and it wouldn't hold the weld. So the bridge is now 3 years behind schedule and almost $1 billion overrun. And we're still not sure that the steel they're making is going to hold the weld. They argued that there wasn't an American company that could build the bridge. The language I would use in response I can't use on this show.
Yeah. You know,
the reality is we built the first bridge. There's no reason we couldn't have built the second bridge.
You know, when you're talking about China, and one of the things that I think can sometimes get lost in the shuffle is that to a significant extent, for some of America's largest transnational corporations that are based here, that were built here, that got their wealth here, they've just transferred a lot of their operations to China, and so it's not like these are Chinese companies competing with American companies taking jobs from American companies. These are American companies that are basically offloading their jobs to low-wage areas.
It's a function of what I've called labor arbitrage. They set up these trade deals all over the world, and the most recent three now put three more countries into the mix where you can look at a labor arbitrage. If I want to build this product, where should I build it? They're now working on something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, that's going to bring in the countries of the Pacific Ocean, Indonesia, Vietnam, a whole bunch of other countries that are on the Pacific Rim. And so they'll then have a complete labor arbitrage system almost anywhere in the world. You can decide where will you put your plant to make this product with the least interference possible, at the lowest wages possible. And that's the reason you end up with the Occupy Wall Street, the Occupy movement. Is there is no way out of this mess. I mean, we're getting fed a lot of baloney here. There is no way out of this mess by continuing to do what we've been doing for the last 25 years.
Let's go to our last caller who has been waiting very patiently. Let's go to Line 1, West Peoria. You're on the air with Leo Girard.
Hello. The Steelworkers Local 7669 really fought the good fight in their 13-month lockout down in Metropolis, Illinois, against the Honeywell plant there, which is one of the only places where we enrich yellow cake into uranium hexafluoride. And that was all over Honeywell wanting to increase the workers' health care out of pocket. And if you're working in a uranium enrichment plant, it stands to reason that you're going to get sick. You're probably going to get cancer of some sort, and it seems like a good health care plan should just be part and parcel of working there. But instead, they were locked out, and Honeywell ran it with scab labor, and there was at least two explosions. And my question is, why was it never really a major story outside of a few newspaper articles here and there? I mean, I can understand why the proxy for General Electric might not cover something that would affect their sales of nuclear power plants, but why wasn't this a bigger issue? Why wasn't it a national issue? This is one that I think was a missed opportunity that could have really shown how horrible big corporations are to labor. I mean, yellow cake into enriched uranium.
All right, well, thank you very much, caller. I think you've given us a lot to chew on there. Leo Girard?
I think that's a terrific question. It goes back to a question that you've asked me and others have asked me. Why doesn't the media jump on this? Because there's no labor reporters. The editors that make the editing assignments, they don't bother with that story. That's this, that's that. Let me say on behalf of the workers in Metropolis, you know, Metropolis is Superman's hometown. And we mobilized all over the world. The thing that's really funny, or not funny, funny's the wrong word. The thing that's really sad is this story got more coverage in Europe than it got outside of Metropolis, outside of Illinois in America. that we send people all over the world talking about this and exposing, because Honeywell is one of the nation's largest defense contractors and one of its most profitable companies. And here they were taking on the group of workers that enrich uranium, and they were literally wanting to strip them of their pensions and their health care, make health care such as they would barely be able to afford anything else, and make their pensions less effective. And we took them on for over a year. And the caller's right. The American media, outside of a small network around Metropolis, basically ignored it. And we had the strategic campaign. We took people to Washington. We had Senate support from the senators, from Senator Durbin, and still couldn't get coverage. And you know, it goes to the issue that you raised about there's not a labor reporter in a newspaper in the country we can find.
Leo Gerard, I suspect we have a lot of listeners who are in this camp, and I suspect there are countless Americans in this camp, people who are sympathetic to organized labor, who are very sympathetic to the agenda you've laid out for the country and the economy, but they are not either in a position where they can join unions or whatever, but they still want to be supportive of labor and what it delivers for the country. Is there a place for them in the labor movement? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think that there's a place for them in the labor movement, and let me put a plug in for the steelworkers. We have an associate member program, and we've got, surprisingly, we've got a couple of guys that work on Wall Street that are sympathetic to unions. They're associate members. We've got a number of folks who are staff, legislative staff in Washington who want to be associate members. So we've got close to 21,000 people from all different walks of life who aren't in a workplace that's traditionally organized, who have joined our union's associate member program, and they can get to that by going to our website, usw.org. And I'm very proud of that, and they play an active role. I was in Ohio yesterday, and we had three people come up to me and introduce themselves and said, we're associate members, and this is what we do for a living. And I got to tell you, it made me very proud. They're not traditional dues payers, but they're people who want to be part of our union, involved in our struggles, and be supportive, and our associate members.
We're down to the last minute or so, President Gerard. And, you know, I was just wondering if you could close with some thoughts on the way you see going forward that progressives and people who are sympathetic to labor can, you know, win in the near future, or at least make great advances against what you've already described as the intense corruption of our governing system right now.
Yeah, I think in the extremely short term, if anybody could jump in their car and go to Ohio and on Monday and Tuesday help us pull the vote to send Kasich a solid rejection. I think we have to fight in Wisconsin to let them know that we're not going to put up with that. We need to have a fight against taking the money out of politics and just ask ourselves a question. Do you know of any other democratic society where someone has said, you can't stop spending money in politics, money equals speech? What that really says is the more money you got, the louder your voice is, and then to enhance that by saying it can be undisclosed amounts. I mean, that is an attack on democracy.
Leo Gerard, I hear the band tuning up in the background.
And last but not least, elect a lot of Democrats next year because we can take this back.
Thank you so much, Leo Gerard. President of the United Steelworkers, for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been an honor having you with us for the full hour.
Been an honor to be on. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Sure thing. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, Melissa Trentz, my producer, Christina Williams, who's, I guess, associate producer. We'll follow that for the time being. And I'll be back 167 hours with Glenn Greenwald, everyone. Until then, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois. Today, mostly sunny with a high near 63. Tonight, a 50% chance of showers after midnight, cloudy with a low around 50. Monday, showers likely and possibly a thunderstorm, cloudy with a high near 59. Monday night, showers likely and cloudy with a low around 52.